KQED.
This is the California Report. Good morning. I'm John Sepulvedo. The entire country is waiting to see if Congress can come to an agreement or another extension on a new spending bill. If not, the federal government could be shut down at midnight on Friday. So what would that mean for California? KQED's Katie Orr has the answer.
Unless you're one of the 252,000 federal employees working in California, you may not initially notice much of a difference if the government shuts down.
The most obvious thing that Californians will see is national parks being closed.
H.D. Palmer is with Governor Jerry Brown's Department of Finance.
But most of the major federal programs, such as Social Security or unemployment benefits, not any immediate impact or effect at all.
Palmer says if the shutdown were to drag on for several weeks, it could affect state programs that count on federal employees or dollars to operate. But in the short term, it's likely to be a nuisance more than anything else. Passport and visa applications could be delayed, as could some mortgage approvals. Mail delivery would continue, and the military would remain operational. Robert Kleinhens is an economist with Beacon Economics. He says the most tangible impact could be to federal workers who don't receive their paycheck.
For people who are living from paycheck to paycheck, there's a real possibility that they'll be unable to pay bills.
Kleinhens says a brief government shutdown would have a negligible impact on the state's economy. He says a longer shutdown could affect California's finances, though he says the state would most likely make up the lost economic activity later. For the California Report, I'm Katie Orr in Sacramento.
The city of Oroville is suing the California Department of Water Resources over alleged corruption and mismanagement that led to a near disaster at the nation's tallest dam. KQED's Dan Brecky has the story.
The failure of Oroville Dam's spillways last February led to fears of catastrophic flooding and prompted emergency evacuations for 188,000 people. The Oroville lawsuit calls Department of Water Resources Management a den of improper behavior and says the agency's culture of corruption led to poor inspections and maintenance of the spillway. The suit also alleges DWR condoned racial and sexual harassment of workers at the Oroville site and tried to silence workers who expressed concerns about conditions at the facility. The department says it does not comment on pending litigation. For the California Report, I'm Dan Brecky.
We're going to turn now to the ongoing opioid crisis. California has one of the lowest death rates from opioids. That is cold comfort for the five people who will die today because of opioid usage. Those deaths are based on yearly fatality averages over the past 3 years in the state. Assemblyman Evan Lowe, a Democrat from Campbell, has introduced three bills aimed at identifying and tracking opioid prescriptions. With that, we welcome him to the California Report. Assemblyman.
Good morning.
So these three measures that you're proposing really seem to be aimed at stopping both doctor shopping and the aftermarket illicit opioid prescription drug trade.
Right now, providers have up to a 7-day window, which allows for patients in that time to seek other serious drugs and visit multiple doctors. Whereas we have the database and the information available and the technology to provide that on a 24-hour window instead of 7 days. So it's a multi-pronged approach.
So wait, it sounds to me what you're saying is that we can't get to a place where we're actually holding doctors accountable until we have better data to be able to provide them so that they can make more well-informed decisions and potentially be more culpable for their actions.
I think this is an approach that I am pursuing.
Why not punish the pharmaceutical industry? Why not hold them accountable? Why not do something to limit their sales within the state of California?
Yes, in fact, now is the time in which we are taking a look at our bill package. One of the issues that we have explored, trying to prohibit advertisements of such prescription drugs to the general marketplace. But therein lies some other unique challenges that might exist with
because of the First
to
Amendment.
Freedom
of
speech. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I've spoken to many parents who believe that the pharmaceutical industry is singularly responsible for the opioid crisis. Again, because there has been this dramatic uptick in opioid deaths that coincide with the introduction to market of these pain pills. Have you spoken to the pharmaceutical industry? Have you talked to them?
We are currently engaged in reaching out to all stakeholders. And so everyone and all different stakeholders are trying to best assess which bills target which segment of this issue at hand.
But I know that part of the reason that I'm so passionate about it is because I've had several friends who have passed away because of opioid addiction. And when I talk to parents and when I talk to victims and even myself, and this is me stepping away as an objective journalist and just thinking and feeling as a human being, I'm angry because it seems that nothing is done. And I think to myself, well, what good is the government if they can't protect its people and especially protect often the least among us?
I've always said that government does not always have all of the answers, but that we require individuals like yourselves to help hold us accountable and to develop the conversation for the obligation that we have to the health and safety of the populations that we represent. I will say that I am optimistic. I recognize the same type of concern that you have in pessimism, but I will say, even as I have talked to Republican colleagues of the legislature, they have sought me out and said that they would like to partner on this issue too. In a hyper-partisan climate, on an issue like this, at least I have seen a significant amount of engagement from individuals from all parties to find out how we can address this problem.
Assemblyman Evan Lowe, Democrat of Campbell. Assembly member, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your passion. Appreciate it.
The mudslides that hit Santa Barbara County last week continued to clog a main artery for cars and trucks trying to get through the area. With the 101 freeway still closed, KPCC's David Wagner looks at the effect on local business.
Caltrans estimates about 7,500 trucks normally pass through this stretch of the 101 every day. But now, with it closed down, some farmers say it's been hard to get shipments out. And getting shipments out on time is crucial for the area's many flower growers. June Van Wingerden is the co-owner of Ocean Breeze Farms in Carpinteria.
With cut flowers, we harvest almost every day, so we ship almost every day.
But she couldn't ship just after the mudslides.
We lost at least 2 days of shipping, and that cost us probably $50,000 a day in lost revenue.
She says drivers are back to making deliveries, but one trip that normally takes 3 hours is now taking 8. After the fires, the mudslides, and then the freeway closure, she's ready for business to get back to normal sometime soon. For the California Report, I'm David Wagner in Los Angeles.
Several California officials and lawmakers reacted to a report, the keyword being a report of a potential massive sweep by immigration agents around the San Francisco Bay Area. KQED's Farida Jabalo Romero reports.
In response to a report by the San Francisco Chronicle that more than 1,500 undocumented immigrants could be arrested, Democrats in Congress Nancy Pelosi and Ro Khanna said any such raids would be political retaliation for the state's sanctuary law. Attorney General Javier Becerra says the state will continue working with federal counterparts to go after serious criminals or potential terrorists.
But Donald Trump should not ask us to be a deportation force for his immigration enforcement activities. We're not in the business of deportation. We're in the business of public safety.
A spokesman for Immigration and Customs Enforcement declined to confirm possible raids, but acting ICE Director Thomas Homan says the agency must make arrests in the community because sanctuary laws prevent them from doing so in jails. John Eastman is a law professor at Chapman University in Orange County. He says ICE is taking the right approach.
If you're an administration devoted to enforcing federal law, and you're not getting any cooperation whatsoever from local officials, then devoting more resources to actually enforce federal law in those jurisdictions is perfectly appropriate.
Immigrant advocates in several Bay Area cities are on alert, with rapid response networks prepared to offer legal aid if immigrants are arrested. For the California Report, I'm Farida Jabala Romero.
Okay, so tech companies call it the smart home. You know, your refrigerator talks to Amazon, your doorbell talks to Apple, your virtual assistant talks to your children. How do you feel about that last one? Here's KQED's Rachel Miro.
Graham Charles is a stay-at-home dad in San Francisco with two daughters, a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old.
Hi, I'm Claudia.
Hi, I'm Fern.
That's Bart the Poodle Mix. They've had an Amazon Echo Dot for a little over a year. The girls like to use it for help with homework and to play music. A lot of kids also like to encourage virtual assistants to say bad words or make fart sounds. But I don't want to get anybody in trouble here, so let's show off a different feature.
What would you like me to sing?
Pizza.
Even if Charles bought the Dot, the virtual assistant is tracking everyone in the home who talks to it. The ostensible intent of the tracking is to deliver a more satisfying, personalized experience. But there are other directives to track your habits for advertisers and to make shopping effortless. What stops the girls from stuffing Charles's Amazon shopping cart with chocolate or chips or whatever?
You know, I haven't done that before, but that's a good idea.
I'm corrupting your children. Oh, no.
I don't think they've made the connection between Alexa and Amazon, really, but you can.
Charles says he's not really worried about his kids behaving badly or companies tracking his family, be they Amazon or Nabisco. Now, some consumer advocates say advertisers shouldn't be allowed to track, but Charles says,
I think the only thing that keeps kids safe is teaching them how to keep themselves safe.
Yelda Yules agrees. She's a research scientist who studies children and media at UCLA and consults with Common Sense Media, a nonprofit advocacy group for parents. She says there is no privacy for anyone in the way older generations used to think of it, not even for kids.
Their lives are online, you know. Some children have been tracked since they were in utero.
What you can do, Yule says, is help them navigate this brave new world. Be a mentor, not just a policeman.
We're in an attention economy, and yes, these devices grab our attention possibly more than, you know, a movie did or a TV show did. So teach your child to be a smart consumer and to think about things.
If Yules lies awake at night worrying about the future, it's usually because she just watched an episode of the science fiction show Black Mirror. Things typically end badly when humans interface with new technologies. But that's science fiction, right? For the California Report, I'm Rachel Miro in San Jose.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children and youth at risk. Personal Capital, the website that shows all financial accounts in one place and helps plan for retirement, personalcapital.com. And by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose fund for strategic innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.
The new year started on a disappointing note for one group. Abalone divers normally harvest the mollusks in springtime north of San Francisco Bay. The iconic red abalone is in such serious trouble that state fish and wildlife officials voted to close the North Coast sport fishery for the first time ever. Reporter Sherry Quinn spent a day with a scientist at the beach during one of the last times divers could harvest the prized abalone.
A remote beach a few hours north of San Francisco bustles with dozens of abalone divers boasting about their catches. But Dr. Cynthia Catton, an environmental scientist with the California Fish and Wildlife Service, sees something else when she analyzes the abalone as they emerge from the water. Signs of starvation.
We're seeing dying abalone that have just fallen off the rock.
Catton and her team of volunteers turn the reddish shells upside down, exposing the mollusks' mushy bodies. She calls out their measurements of their glistening dark gray foot muscles, the succulent edible meat. The higher the number between 0 and 4, the more likely they are to be starving to death.
I would probably call that at least a 2, but it's close to 3.
Catton has looked at 6,000 abalone over the past few years, and more than 25% showed signs of starvation. Underwater surveys reveal even grimmer results.
In areas where we would normally see abalone all over the reef, we're seeing piles and piles of shells.
Those results led to a decision to close the North Coast to red abalone sport fishing in 2018. The mollusks are so scarce that divers have been risking their lives to collect them in deeper, more dangerous waters. Since 2015, more than a dozen divers have died trying.
The collapse of this fishery is devastating, especially for these small communities on the North Coast that really rely on tourism that these fisheries bring in.
Overfishing is an issue, but climate change is the main culprit. Warming ocean water has weakened the abalone's food source, kelp, and so there isn't enough seaweed to go around. As a result, the abalone are malnourished and dying off in alarming numbers. the North Coast now joins Southern California, where all abalone harvesting has been banned since 1998. For the California Report, I'm Sherry Quinn in Point Arena.
Let's stay in the water. The sea lion population along the West Coast has tripled in the past 40 years to more than 250,000. In a study released on Wednesday, federal biologists say the environmental laws that have been enacted to protect sea lions have done their jobs, as KQED's Paul Rogers tells us.
You know, this really is an environmental success story, and overall it shows that the oceans are pretty healthy off of the West Coast. In fact, we have so many sea lions in some places that they're causing problems. We've heard of them biting swimmers in Aquatic Park in San Francisco. They've eaten endangered salmon and caused some problems on the Columbia River. But overall, the recovery of this species is a good thing. It shows environmental laws do work, and it shows that species are pretty resilient if we just leave them alone and let them recover.
Sea lion woman, she drink coffee.
And that is the California Report for Thursday, January 18th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm John Sepulveda. Have a great day.
Sea lion woman, dressed in red, make a man lose his head. Sea lion woman, sea lion woman. Black dress on for thy